I'd like to welcome all of you to our latest version of Global Health Perspectives podcast. My name is Derek Yach, and I'm the president of the Foundation for a Smoke-Free World. We've been having these discussions with friends and colleagues around the world, really working on the nexus of health, smoking, all under this pandemic. And today I'm really thrilled to have Karen Nelson with me. Karen has been a longstanding member of the National Academy of Sciences and the president of the Craig Venter Institute. She has an extraordinary scientific background, but I want to really ask something that I'm intrigued about, that she started as a veterinarian and then ditched all the other species for humans. And I'd just love to learn a little bit about how that transition happened.
Hi, Derek. It's so good to see you and speak to you during these crazy pandemic times. So no, I didn't start as a veterinarian. I started with an interest in being a veterinarian, and I think this is going to be a fabulous conversation for us. My history, in case you hear a little bit of a lilt, is that I'm Jamaican by birth, very proud to be so. And I moved to the United States in the 90s to go to school. And, you know, growing up as a young dreamer and wanting to be a scientist or a researcher in the islands, your options are limited, right? And, you know, I thought I could only be an MD or a vet. And with my love for animals and my passion for science, I dreamt of being a veterinarian. And those dreams were rapidly halted in a pre-vet class where I had to operate on a little piglet. And I'm not sure which one of us left that operation more traumatized. So a gentle advisor I had at that time pulled me aside and suggested that maybe I go the research path. And, you know, I think that's some of the best advice I ever had. And it dovetails into a conversation I'd like to have about opportunities for people in the developing world where they don't see what they can do in the sciences and in research and technology. And just having very good mentors and, for want of a better word, people who have more experience around you to show you that there are different opportunities out there can really change the path of a young person's life. And so, again, that was some really great advice for me. I grew up in Jamaica. I did undergrad at the University of the West Indies in Trinidad and Tobago, and then ended up doing a PhD at Cornell. And all along was able to keep my love of animals and research together. So Right. That's what we're here today.
Fantastic. And we're going to come back to the whole question of mentorship, because I agree that is fundamental to our future. Let me jump into your work on the human microbiome. And we all know you as being right at the birth of what is now an accepted field of scientific endeavor. But it'd be very interesting to learn what drew you into this field. And then we're obviously keen to learn about how you see it evolving and how it has evolved since 15 years plus ago.
Oh, great question. So as I mentioned a while ago, I kept my love of animals and research together and, you know, science, my curiosity about science. And while at Cornell, I ended up looking at the microbes that are associated with animals. And so what most of us don't realize is that the gastrointestinal tracts and the oral cavity and the skin of animals are associated with millions and millions, if not trillions and billions of microbial species that are important for their health. I think we understand microbes when they become pathogens and we think they're all bad for us, but it turns out they're all important for animal production, they're important for the health of the environment, and they're also very important for humans. So with the merging of technology and my microbiology experience and my love of animals, looking at human poop seemed like a logical next step. And so in 2006, my team published this study of two humans where we described the microbial diversity in human stool, and we were stunned to see how much microbial diversity there was. Traditionally, we had used culture-based approaches to look at the microbes that live in the environment. And as we had new sequencing technology, we were able to look at communities in mass and describe the tremendous amount of microbes, both beneficial and non-beneficial, and the functional capability of these organisms that exist in humans. And that has launched a tremendous field there where everybody today uses the buzzword human microbiome, right? Yeah. So I'm very proud of that achievement, but a lot of that was driven by access to new technologies that gave us the ability to interrogate large aspects of genetic material.
Yeah, so when you look at some of the applications now we have about that knowledge, you know, we can see that it's spurred a whole lot of food and nutritional company innovation and a whole lot of intervention studies as well. What do you see as where this is likely to go for patient care? Do you think we will start to actually want to have our microbiome analysis done in a routine way and that we do for other biological measures?
I like to think of the microbiome field as being similar to all other new research areas, right? So there's a lot of excitement at first, and people want to press the easy button and think it's a simple question. But as this field has expanded, and if you think back to the gene therapy days or the early days of the human genome, you know, there was a lot of learning that had to happen. And so now, for example, in the microbiome space, we realize that people differ by a geographical location, their microbiomes differ by their diet, their age, their exposures, and there's a little bit of post-genetic component that weighs into it. So the early phases of the microbiome field focus on very small cohorts of maybe 30 or 40 people at a time. And now we're realizing that you have to do very large, statistically robust studies, preferably in different geographic locations so that you're able to compare across different communities. And if you think about it, it makes sense, right? Why would we think that the microbiome of somebody living in North America is going to be the same as somebody, a hunter-gatherer in the African Republic, Central African Republic? So now that we've been able to think more, we realize that it's, you know, the microbes are a lot more complicated than we appreciated. We can't live without them. They're important for us. They're important for oral health. They're important for gastrointestinal health. And but I think the studies that are being performed today, a lot of them can't be duplicated reliably. And it's a major issue is because of geography and the number of people included in the studies to make statistical conclusions. But it's a tremendously fascinating field. And I do think that we will get to a point where microbiome swabs will be taken to correlate with various diseases, right? I'm sure we'll talk about this a little bit more, but already we're starting to see hints that microbiomes are correlated positively and negatively with certain diseases. And I do believe that ultimately we'll be able to develop these into good diagnostic tests.
Yeah, I think I know that some of the work you've been looking at and I've been trying to learn from is showing the extraordinarily interesting links between the gut microbiome and the brain. And it'd be good just to have a few comments on where is your thinking about that now?
So this is one of the areas that I'm most fascinated about, right? So you can have microbes in your gut, and they're able to produce molecules that have an activity very distant from the location where the microbes live. So we're not saying that the microbes in your gut swim to your brain and live in your brain, but they're able to produce molecules that somehow have some kind of alterative effect, right? And we're seeing this across Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, many diseases that are associated with the gut-brain axis. And so I do think we need a lot more research in this area, both on the negative and the positive side. And I think we'll get into this a little bit further because I know Parkinson's is one of your favorite topics. But there are these curiosities about these molecules that are being produced by microbes and how they can either positively or negatively impact brain health. And you know that chocolate makes you happy, right? So there must be some correlation somewhere.
Yeah. Obviously, we're very interested in the work you're now doing, looking at smoking, non-smokers, and the microbiome. And I'd love to know whether you have any early sense of differences. Can you detect the difference in the microbiome population of a smoker versus an ex-smoker, non-smoker? And in that, do we yet have a sense of whether nicotine is playing a role at all, or whether it's all the other stuff in cigarettes?
So, great question. You know that I have a tremendous interest in anything in terms of the positive and negative benefits of these microbes. And I have been an advocate for studying the human microbiome and its correlation with health and disease and all environmental impacts, right? So if you think about diet and small molecules in the environment and smoke and smoke inhalation, it just becomes part of this question of what is a long-term impact on the microbiome. And so the work that has been done to date has looked primarily at very small numbers of people. There's nothing really robust and concrete available yet, but I do believe that we are going to see correlations between smokers, non-smokers, and with vapors. And also, we're going to find out that there are some microbes that are present in healthy people that might be beneficial to people who are trying to get away from exposures to, for want of a better word, toxic compounds, right? And then I think to get into your nicotine question, it's not really, is it smoke in general, or are there some molecules within cigarette smoke that are associated with positive and negative effects? So there are many, many questions that remain to be answered. This area of research, for some reason, was kind of neglected until now. I don't see a lot of work that's been performed in this space, but I think that we plan to make significant advances in this space. And also, one thing that you see in the literature is that smoking correlates significantly with periodontal disease, and periodontal disease correlates with a lot of other diseases in the human body. So there's that link that also we have this great opportunity to investigate further.
Yeah, and I know that that's something you're looking at. Just in the last couple of weeks, colleagues published the largest review of the use of smokeless tobacco around the world, reminding us that a range of smokeless tobaccos explain very high levels of mouth cancer, particularly in South Asia. And anything we can do to further understand how you could detect it early, prevent it, what is the impact on the flora of the mouth, I think would be very valuable. And I know you're looking at that, but as you say, it's been an area where there's been extremely limited work.
Yeah. And I hope, you know, it's probably, there was a lot more lower hanging fruit that was easier to get access to. Certain diseases people had a lot more interest in, like the GI disorders. And I think now there's going to be this gradual push into addressing some of these questions because, you know, there's this curious correlation between nicotine and the Prevotella and Parkinson's disease, right? Yes. And I believe that that's an area of research that absolutely warrants more investigation, right? Because you're not, there's a molecular mechanism that we have not yet drilled down to completely understand what happens with certain molecules in certain settings, for want of a better word. So a great field of research, great opportunity, and also a great model for what we perceive as, you know, negative behaviors in general and how we can be advocates for GI health and microbiome health in people who are trying to improve their health in general.
Yeah, and during the pandemic, I'm sure you must have been taking a look at whether there's any potential role of the microbiome in COVID-19 or in how people are responding to it. Is that something you've been able to do, or has the reality of the pandemic meant that your research has really just been very tough to do?
Well, great question. I think in general, you know, things like recruitment and having people mailing samples in have been stunted a little bit because we are not sure if the virus remains active over time. And so there are all these issues that groups are dealing with. And plus, a lot of attention has been turned towards just developing new diagnostics and possible therapeutics, right? And so there has been, in general, some work where people have tried to see if the virus remains active in stool samples and can we develop better ways to diagnose outcomes from people who get the infection. But I think that with time, we are going to find out that there is some kind of correlation between infection rates and certain microbial species, because if we eventually found out with the flu, for example, that there are certain relationships with the lung exposure for people who get infected versus not infected. But that's taken a lot of time to come to those conclusions. So I wouldn't be surprised if eventually we are in a position where we can either use stool or lung or oral swabs to predict outcomes or likelihood of picking up infections. But the attention has not really been on the microbiome per se. It's more been on trying to get this virus under control. As you know.
Yeah. So Karen, just the last question, to go back to the first points you were talking about, capacity building, and you know, our own work has shown very clearly big research gaps in terms of the engagement of scientists in low middle income countries, and in particular also the low engagement of women in many of the areas of science leadership required for change. And I know this is something you think about and are actively been involved in over your career. And I'd love advice that you might have, both for us as a foundation and for our grantees, focused on how do we actually do the right thing to stimulate the greater involvement of women and folk from low middle income countries in the scientific endeavor, knowing that the world will benefit if we get that right.
Great question. I like to think of myself as an example. I came from a low-income country and was able to stimulate the development of the field. And a lot of it came through opportunity, good mentors, and having good role models around me and people who encouraged me along the way. I still try to give back. You know, this week I did a Zoom call with a 10-year-old who was trying to understand her microscope. And I have presented to 1,000 people in a room in India when I was inducted into the National Academies of India. And I think, you know, it's so important for us as a community to get out there and get young children, both males and females, excited and let them understand the opportunities that are there. You know, a lot of people, young people, think that it's somebody in a lab coat with a pipette standing up in some bizarre lab somewhere, but there are tremendous opportunities. There are genetic counselors. There are legal components to understanding research. We've seen the global motivation with trying to understand COVID and the COVID pandemic. And it's through having young people with bright minds who can help us move towards the future that that's where we need to be as a community. And I think it's very important for us to fund research in low and middle income countries and just have great role models out there showing the next generation that it's okay, it's going to be hard, you're going to get rejected, your papers are going to get rejected, your grants are going to get rejected sometimes, but you know, you get an opportunity to do something you love and probably launch a new field. So I'm a very passionate advocate for the need for this to happen, but I think, you know, it's very complicated. Girls get discouraged at a young age, and we as a community need to be doing a better job. I've been in this field for 30 years, and I'm still saying the same thing 30 years on, that we don't have enough people who look like us out there doing the work and being role models. But hopefully that will get better.
And one of the things we will obviously come back to you about to give us inspirational ideas is work we're starting to look at the next generation of current tobacco farmers in poor countries, Malawi, India, for example, where we believe that the daughters of current tobacco farmers should be given a chance to go into science-based opportunities. And we've seen how when this happens, you know, in Afghanistan, young girls getting involved in coding is really leapfrogging over what would be a more traditional route. And the question we're going to have is, how could we accelerate that in countries where currently livelihoods depend upon a crop that is going down, and we hope will continue to go down because of the health consequences, but the leaving people in rural areas without the wherewithal is obviously a huge problem.
Totally. And I think that that's something that needs to happen, and that's so tremendous. You know, I saw a documentary recently about a young person who figured out how to pump water and change the whole village. And so there are many opportunities out there, but they need that firsthand to reach out and help them just to, you know, get from school into high school. A lot of young girls have to stay home and look after younger children rather than to be able to finish school. So I do feel that both as role models and as funders, that it's up to us to get out there and try and make a difference.
Great. Well, thanks enormously, Karen. And let's hope that as the pandemic eventually starts waning, we can get back to the importance of the work and have a difference on people's lives. And I want also other people to know that you can contact us at podcast@smokefreeworld.org. And please remember, we are still in the middle of a pandemic. Stay safe. The masks do make a difference. Social distancing makes a difference. And we will get through this. Thank you again, Karen.
Thank you.